Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. President Trump has talked tough on trade for years. He made resentment with China a hallmark of his campaign rhetoric, and he's continued in the White House. Top American officials from his administration are arriving in Beijing tomorrow, aiming to defuse tensions after Trump's explicit call for tariffs on Chinese imports last month. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin says he's cautiously optimistic, but China has said it will reject the White House's toughest trade demands out of hand. Can this economic marriage be saved? Is the U.S. headed for a deal with China or trade war? This hour on Point, the U.S.-China trade talks and what it means for the global economy. You can join us on air or online. What do you see coming out of this week's trade talks? Can the U.S. and China come to an agreement? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook, all at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Beijing is Keith Bradshaw. He's an economics reporter and the Shanghai bureau chief for the New York Times. He's been covering this story. You can find a link to his recent article at our website, onpointradio.org. Keith, welcome to On Point.
Hi, David. Thank you for having me on the show.
Keith, I want to start by giving our listeners a little bit of a feel of what it means for tough talk. Trump obviously talked on the campaign trail a lot about it. Last November, he made a 13-day trip to Asia. At that point, President Trump asserted that the United States will no longer turn a blind eye to trading abuses, and he specifically pointed to China.
We will never again turn a blind eye to trading abuses, to cheating, economic aggression, or anything else from countries that profess a belief in open trade but do not follow the rules or live by its principles themselves.
And then more recently, in March, here's what National Trade Council Director Peter Navarro said. He was speaking on MSNBC about what he called the White House's defensive economic policy regarding China.
We are defending ourselves strategically against a strategic mission by China to acquire the intellectual property and technologies of the world. And how do I know this? Because if you look at the Chinese 2006 medium to long range plan for science technology, they identify every major sector of the economy of the future, and they tell us exactly how they're going to go about getting that technology from us and from the rest of the world.
So Keith Bradshaw, help set the scene for us. What's really at stake? What are American officials exercised about, and what do they hope to accomplish in Beijing?
To some extent, there are two different camps in the administration, and with them, it depends on what they're exercised about and what they hope to accomplish. Treasury Secretary Mnuchin has focused on more traditional American goals that previous administrations have also focused on. Questions like whether or not American banks can own banks in China entirely, or whether they can just sort of take small minority stakes in them. Questions of whether or not American automakers like Ford and General Motors can own 100% of the factories they have in China, or whether they have to continue to owning them, whether they have to continue to own them 50-50 with Chinese automakers. So those are more the traditional concerns. Now, you have another camp in the administration led by Bob Lighthizer, the United States Trade Representative, and also I think most people would include Peter Navarro in that group as well, who say that the United States should also be worried about China's very ambitious industrial policies. So China is planning to spend $300 billion in the next 7 years to turn itself really into a powerhouse in 10 sectors that China wants to be essentially, or to a considerable extent, self-sufficient in. And those tend to be, those have a lot of cornerstones of the U.S. economy. So they want to produce a lot of their own commercial aircraft, which would be a threat to Boeing. And of course, in all of these, they're hoping as well to export, so they would challenge the American companies in global markets. So they want to be, they want to use a lot of government money and loans from state-owned banks to become powerhouses in commercial aircraft, which affects Boeing, semiconductors, which affects Intel, artificial intelligence, which affects Google and to some extent Apple.
Presumably Microsoft and Amazon and all these giants.
Microsoft, you name it. They're basically the tech sector. They won't be, they also spend a lot of money on electric cars, which could potentially affect General Motors and Ford as well if you see those if you see the global markets moving more towards electric cars. They're also interested in robotics, which would affect companies like Boston Dynamics and practically any company that uses industrial robots.
I mean, what you're describing are
rail equipment and so forth. Agricultural equipment, which affects John Deere in the Midwest, industries like that.
Keith, what you're describing is sort of vast swaths of the American economy that the Chinese are investing a lot of money in. What is the – I mean, best case scenario, the trade officials go over there, they jaw and the Chinese say, gosh, you do sure do make a compelling case. Did the Trump administration officials say they expect or at least hope to get out of this if we're thinking about such big issues as opposed to more narrowly defined arguments over intellectual property?
Well, this is the tough part about it, is they are hoping – there are two different possibilities. One is that they persuade the Chinese government to pull back on its industrial policy plans. It is worth mentioning that there are some shades of opinion within China on this. There are some, including in the government, who worry that throwing vast amounts of money at all of these very expensive industries is going to increase the debt at a time when China already has a big domestic debt. So it is conceivable that maybe China would say, oh, we do need some controls on the scale of this industrial policy. But it's not likely. So I was very fortunate, along with my colleague, the New York Times columnist Tom Friedman, to go to very high-level seminar with some of the top government economic policymakers that was just held by Tsinghua University here in Beijing over the weekend. And I should mention also that Tom Friedman's column is out today, and that also involves some of these same issues that my story covered yesterday. His is a much more analytical look at it all.
Sure. Tell us what happened at the seminar.
Well, at the seminar, mostly they were taking the tack that we need Made in China 2025. Their tack is, look, industrial policy works. The United States should have one. And they even said, if the United States were to have an industrial policy, we would not object. They think that some use of government money and government-directed bank loans can be effective in building up the industries of tomorrow. The main success story in this area is solar panels. I've written a bunch about that over the past decade, and I can remember even when I was first writing these stories I did a series on this in 2009. I was already covering the Chinese industrial policy then, and some people in the West were a little bit skeptical about throwing massive loans at the Chinese solar panel sector, but the banks did throw a lot of money at it. Now, on the one hand, they had some failures. There were three very large bankruptcies of Chinese solar panel companies, and the Chinese banks only got back 30 cents on the dollar in the first bankruptcy, 15 cents on the dollar in the second bankruptcy, and 6 cents on the dollar
Not all these things immediately play out, right?
Exactly. So, but on the other hand, the price of solar panels dropped 90% as they built huge solar panel factories. Because the thing about solar panels is there are a lot of economies of scale. Nobody before the Chinese industrial policy came along was willing to think not just about 50 megawatt factories, but they started building them 500 megawatts and 5,000 megawatts, 100-fold increases in capacity, immense operations with 3,000 employees at the time. So the price of solar panels collapsed down to the point that it's now competitive with coal. And who totally dominates that market? China. So China now produces the market for solar panels has exploded. But the market, the production of Chinese companies has exploded even faster, and out of a far, far, far larger market, they have 75% of the world market, and the American and European companies are barely holding on by their fingernails.
So, Keith Bradshaw, let's take a moment and you know, listen to some of the rhetoric on the Chinese side. The state media has a message for the U.S. through state media in one thing, an editorial published in the Global Times, which is a state-owned publication. They said, Washington had better not expect that its trade war war stick will force Beijing to take whatever the U.S. delegation offers. The imminent dialogue must be held on an equal footing, and the U.S. delegation has to come with sincerity. I want to bring in another voice now. Daniel Griswold is director of the program on the American economy and globalization at George Mason University's Mercatus Center. You can find a link to his op-ed headline, "There's No Pot of Gold at the End of a Trade War with China," on our website. Dan Griswold, welcome to the show.
Hi, David.
Before we go to our first break, I want to ask you, thinking about what was said in the Global Times and thinking about the Chinese stance, what is the likeliness of their willingness to yield in the face of, you know, fairly tough rhetoric from the Trump administration, particularly from the President Trump himself?
I think their chances of doing everything President Trump has demanded they do, including cutting the bilateral deficit by $100 billion and abandoning most of their economic policies, is zero.
Zero.
But I do think there's a chance they will offer liberalization, lower tariffs, allowing more investment of U.S. companies in their sector, like the auto sector that you mentioned. These would be real incremental gains. China has liberalized a lot over the last 30 years, so it wouldn't be a sharp U-turn. It would be a commitment to continue liberalizing. I think that's the best we can hope for, and I think that would actually be the best outcome, a continuation of our trade relationship with China moving towards more openness and liberalization of its domestic economy.
In the last 30 seconds before break, Dan Griswold, you know, if they do offer those incremental liberalizing policies, a bit more openness to their markets, those reforms, should Donald Trump get some credit for his bluster as an effective negotiating tactic?
I think so. He should get credit for declaring victory and getting out. I think if he continues to insist that they do everything he demands, we're headed for a trade war and there will be no winners there. Americans and Chinese will lose from a confrontation of mounting tariffs and retaliation.
Well, we'll see if the art of the deal can be accomplished here in Beijing this week and in coming days. Keith Bradshaw of the New York Times, Dan Griswold, if you'd both hold on for us. We're discussing this week's trade talks between the U.S. and China. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Hey, I'm Kelly McEvers, host of NPR's Embedded, and we've got a new episode all about how Scott Pruitt ended up running the EPA. It's a story about Pruitt's life in the Southern Baptist Church, how he handled a major pollution case, and why he sued the EPA 14 times. Just search for Embedded on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're talking about this week's trade negotiations between the U.S. and China and what they could mean for the future of U.S.-Chinese relations. You can join the conversation. Can we come to an agreement with China on trade? Are we headed for a trade war? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests are Keith Bradshaw, he's Shanghai Bureau Chief for the New York Times, and Daniel Griswold, Director of the Program on the American Economy and Globalization at George Mason University's Mercatus Center. Thank you both. I want to first get to a call from Pam from Johnson City, Tennessee. Pam, go ahead.
Hi, David. Thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
My question is this. How can President Trump negotiate or tell China what to do when our country owes China in the trillions of dollars? You don't tell your mortgage banker, if you have a mortgage on your house, what to do. And that's my question.
Daniel Griswold, you're big in the thinking about trade worlds and trade wars. What do you say to that? That is a refrain that you often hear from common citizens and from that matter, from people in American finance.
Yeah, our caller brings up a really interesting issue. You know, there's a saying that if the investment is large enough, it's actually China's problem to worry. They've given us about $1 trillion that they've invested in our treasury bonds. And by the way, that has helped our federal government keep its operations going at a time of rapidly mounting federal debt. And it's allowed us to fund our military and the government to pay lower interest rates on those treasury bonds. And by the way, millions of American homeowners pay lower interest on their mortgages because of the Chinese money that's been invested in the United States. Actually, I think it gives the Chinese reason to be more cooperative with us. They've got $1 trillion sitting over here that they need to look after. So I think that's the flip side of the trade deficit, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
The president has focused on the $375 billion goods deficit, and one, I think we benefit from the stuff we buy from China. Millions of American families are better off because of the stuff we buy from China. But if China doesn't use those dollars to buy our exports, they're investing in treasury bills, which help keep interest rates down and helps our federal government fund its operations.
And kind of why I earlier referred to it as frenemies. We seem to be deeply integrated as we seem to be in constant competition.
Yes, that's a good way to put it.
You know, I want to hear from a few things that the White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow said earlier this week. He was being interviewed with CNBC, his employer for many years. And Kudlow defended the president's warning to China about trade practices with tariffs. Kudlow said Trump is responding to decades of misdeeds and bad acts by China and that it's time for somebody to say something about it.
Somebody's got to say to China, you are no longer a third world country. You are a first world country, and you've got to act like one. There are laws on the books.
Keith Bradshaw, you know, you think about this. We skated through this lightly earlier, but there are questions about the ways in which, for example, the Chinese government and Chinese industries treat intellectual property laws and things that are vital to American businesses that oftentimes are simply ignored, circumvented, or trampled on by Chinese enterprises. You know, what is the stance of the Chinese toward our desire to protect what would seem to be, you know, internationally protected intellectual property?
There have been a lot of suggestions of abuses in the past in the sense of companies being required to transfer technology in order to set up shop in with factories and sales in China. On the other hand, China is trying to improve its protection of intellectual property. This was one of the points at the seminar that I went to this weekend. One of the very senior officials in the Chinese government said, we want to have an innovation economy, and therefore we know we need to protect innovations so that people will have an incentive to invest in research and development, and that's good for China as well as for foreign countries. So on intellectual property, China is moving the same direction. Now, the challenge for the United States is that as China becomes more of a research and development power in itself, it doesn't want to be producing shoes and toys. It wants to be producing the aircraft engines, artificial intelligence, and so forth. And those are many of the same things that people want to be producing in the United States. But I'd like to address, if I could for a moment, the point of your caller from Tennessee. And that is that the situation regarding Chinese investments in treasuries has really changed a lot in the past decade. A decade ago, Americans were very worried about it because China held more like $2 trillion worth of treasuries, and that was a big share of U.S., of a sizable share of U.S. debt. Now, how did it drop from $2 trillion to $1 trillion? First of all, they had a stock market crash and a currency devaluation here in China 2.5 years ago, and they sold a lot of treasuries to cover the costs of that and stabilize their currency and get the economy back on an even footing. So they don't hold as many treasuries as people used to worry about. Second of all, the overall amount of treasuries out there has increased enormously. We had our own financial crisis, of course, in 2008 and going into the beginning of 2009, and the U.S. government wasn't taking in much tax revenue for a while there and was continuing to spend heavily on things like Medicare and Social Security and so forth. And so as a result, it ended up issuing far more treasuries. So there are far, far more treasuries than there were back when this was an issue, when the Chinese government held $2 trillion. Now they hold $1 trillion. It's out of a much larger number. Huh. And so the U.S. is much less vulnerable to a change in decision-making in Beijing in terms of how much of the treasury debt they hold.
It's fascinating. There's been a ratcheting up of public rhetoric about this at a time. There's been, it sounds like, a ratcheting down of, in some ways, the financial concern. You know, there does seem to be, Dan Griswold, a lot of momentum in the idea of, you know, this would be a good thing to work out. that there are economic reasons to do it. You hear voices within certainly the Republican Party that counsel this. The White House, Wall Street sources of backing for Republicans traditionally, the Chamber of Commerce, there are folks in agriculture business who want that. Nonetheless, there are industries that and American enterprises that are no doubt being hurt by the trade imbalance with China. What would you say? What benefits would you say there would be if, for example, Trump were able to either through tariffs or through tough negotiations be able to get the Chinese either to reduce what they do or enhance what Americans are able to do there?
Yeah. Well, first, let's remind ourselves of the mutual benefits from the existing trade relationship. We're not in a crisis. We have a mutually beneficial win-win-win trade relationship with China. All those goods that we import and not only are good for consumers, but U.S. companies depend on the parts and the industrial supplies. China is a great market for U.S. products and services. They're our number three export market of U.S. goods, and we have an idea what those are, soybeans and semiconductors and aircraft. They actually buy a lot of automobiles. They love American cars. And another thing we forget is that U.S. companies in China sell a lot of goods and services. Over $300 billion worth of goods and services, U.S. branded goods and services, are sold by U.S. affiliates in China. So we have a mutually beneficial relationship. Can it be improved? Yes. And the best way of improvement is for China to continue opening up its economy. David, they joined the World Trade Organization in 2001. We didn't have to do any liberalizing when they joined. They did all the liberalizing. The average Chinese tariff on U.S. exports was 25% before they joined the World Trade Organization. It's now 7%. Our exports have grown at double-digit rates, faster than our imports from China since they joined the World Trade Organization. So let's not throw a very beneficial baby out with the bathwater in our dispute with China.
Dan, why do you think that the administration is not then using the mechanisms in that? There's basically a without getting too technical, kind of a court-like process you can go to and take the Chinese. In fact, if I recall correctly, the Japanese want to join us and some allies in taking the Chinese essentially to this kind of court. And oftentimes the Chinese have been held accountable there, if I'm not mistaken.
David, you're exactly right. Their membership in the WTO has meant that they're subject to the dispute settlement mechanism in the WTO. I won't go into the detail of the cases, but we have taken China to the WTO. We've won, and they've modified their practices.
They've actually been responsive to those rulings.
They have. Also, we have additional leverage with our allies. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, I think the administration's having a little bit of, if I can call it, seller's remorse about not being in the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That's another way of putting pressure on China, is to have this alternative trade arrangement with our partners over there that emphasizes free trade, respect for property rights, and all the other things, intellectual property Americans are trying to spread.
With a bunch of countries in the Pacific, not including China, and the Trump administration pulled out from that last year. Keith Bradshaw, you wanted to weigh in.
Well, I would make the point that while China has been responsive on WTO cases, it has moved slowly. So that's been the criticism on, for example, credit cards. China agreed when it joined WTO in 2001 that it would allow in foreign credit card suppliers like Visa and MasterCard and American Express, so you could go all over the country and you could pay your bills with these credit cards. Well, by 2010, 9 years later, China had not actually done so, so the U.S. filed the WTO case. And then in 2012, the WTO ruled in favor of the United States. And then there were more delays, and so now 6 years later, and 17 years after China joined WTO, China has finally in the past week said that American Express can start opening a national network of being able to use a credit card. But in the meantime, China used that interval to build up its own player called UnionPay, which is now used all over Asia and it's also now expanded into Europe and is expanding into the United States. So the question is not whether China complies with WTO. They do. The worry is, though, when it takes 17 years, then in that time, the commercial world can change somewhat. And so the question is more whether they drag their feet than whether they really comply. I would agree with Dan that the Trans-Pacific Partnership offers potentially a huge opportunity for having more countries have close trade relationships with the United States as alternatives to China. One of the unfortunate things about the Trans-Pacific Partnership is that there are definitely economic reformers in China who thought it would be good if there were a Trans-Pacific Partnership, and because it would be a model for them and they might someday join and maybe rein in some of the state-owned enterprises that demand such large loans from the government and other kinds of support. And they could introduce more market disciplines. But without the Trans-Pacific Partnership, not only does it weaken ties to American allies like Australia, but it also weakens the case for economic reformers in China to rein in some of these big allegedly subsidized operations.
So two shifts that the Trump administration...
One other point, actually, I should make. There's a central point here on why WTO arguably doesn't work as well with China as anywhere else in the world, though. And this is a crucial point. WTO rules say that you can go after a country if they are using public money to help an industry to compete against other countries, for example, in solar panels. The difference in China, though, is that it has a state-controlled banking sector, and that it, what has tended to happen is it's mostly the Chinese banks decide what industries will get loans based on signals from the government, and they provide these enormous loans at extremely low interest rates, the kind of interest rates that only a multinational would pay in the West, but even a startup can get with five people if they're in a favored sector. And so the Chinese government's position, which WTO has agreed with, is that these huge government-directed loans from state-owned banks are not public monies, and therefore you can't do anything about them in a WTO fight. And so that's why you get this lack of confidence that you see now by American trade officials. I was the New York Times reporter in Geneva when WTO was created in 1993. I covered all those trade talks for the U.S., and people didn't really anticipate at the time those talks were going on that you'd end up having a very large economy moving into the WTO in which the question was not public monies, but money from state-owned banks.
Keith Bradshaw, I want to get to the question of sort of expectations. As we've discussed, President Trump and his administration pulled out of that Trans-Pacific Trade Pact, and he's really raised the rhetoric in terms of the relationship to China. He says he's gotten great results. On Monday, during a joint news conference at the White House with the president of Nigeria, the president spoke about the American role in global trade relations.
We hope to be the economic partner of choice for nations across the continent and all around the world, and you see what's happening with respect to trade and the United States. We are being respected again.
Dan Griswold, are we being respected again? Is there a resurgence in respect or fear or regard for the American position as we look around the country, around the globe?
I have to respectfully disagree with our president. I think we've sown a lot of confusion with our allies, Canada, Mexico, Europe, Japan. You know, this administration talks about negotiating bilateral agreements. Where's the line of countries that want to negotiate with us? What country would want to negotiate with this administration and its unreasonable demands? So I think the Trump administration's rhetoric has created a lot of confusion. You see stock markets wobbling and our allies scratching their heads. I think the best that can come out of it is if, after all this bluster, we make modest changes. You know, the Korean free trade agreement is an example of maybe the best we can hope for. There was a lot of bluster about the Korean free trade agreement and the bilateral deficit, but at the end of the day, the administration made a few incremental changes, declared victory, and have moved on to other issues.
I just want to read a couple of comments before we go to break. One from a website from a poster called Plains Dealer. He or she writes, so farmers could take a big hit to Trump due to Trump's trade policies, presumably if there's some sort of tariffs put in place or trade war. That is, unless the president can be persuaded by enough farm state Republicans to abandon them and to implement those trade policies that happen to have been favored by President Obama and Hillary Clinton. Another, Jazo Turner writes, the Chinese are delighted with the geopolitical weakening of the U.S. and the ease with which this president can be flattered and even manipulated. I suspect they view any trade deficit issue as America's problem, not theirs, and that if they throw Trump just enough of a bone that he can call himself a great deal maker and they can walk away from these talks unscathed. We've heard a little bit so far this hour that perhaps getting incremental gains may be the best we can expect. We've been listening to, in part, Keith Bradshaw. He is the Shanghai Bureau Chief for The New York Times. You can find a link to his recent piece on this week's U.S.-China trade talks at our website, onpointradio.org. Keith, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on the show.
I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
I'm Scott Detrow. There is so much political news to follow these days, but you don't have to keep up with all of it. You just have to keep up with us on the NPR Politics podcast. You can find us on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're talking about U.S. trade negotiations in China this week and what they might mean for us and for the world. You can join the conversation. What are the stakes of this week's trade talks for the global economy? How will this affect other issues that are important to the U.S.? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guest is Daniel Griswold. He's director of the Program on American Economy and Globalization at George Mason University's Mercatus Center. And joining me now by Skype from Washington is Yoon Sun. She's co-director of the East Asia Program and director of the China Program at the Stimson Center. She specializes in Chinese foreign policy and in U.S.-China relations. Yoon, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, David, for having me.
I'm delighted you're here. I wanted to ask you a little bit about how you see this playing out in the Pacific economy and how you what importance you attach to this. Is this just sort of the latest little blip in a series of blips that occur over the decades, or is there something consequential playing out at the moment?
Well, I think there is something very different and very significant with this round of the trade dispute or the trade rhetoric between U.S. and China. The trade issue has been a consistent issue between U.S. and China, and Beijing knows this very well. And Beijing has developed a pretty successful record or behavior pattern to fend off Washington's complaints here and there, give Washington a package here and there, or agree to some economic deals with the United States. But I think, at least from the Chinese perspective, based on the conversations that I have had with Chinese interlocutors, the Chinese do identify that President Trump is different from his predecessors. Not only that, the level of pressure from Washington is much higher, and the Americans have demonstrated, at least for the Chinese perception, have demonstrated a much more dedicated efforts and the perseverant, resolute to see concessions from China on trade with the United States. So I would say that is distinctly different from the previous experiences.
So from your standpoint, the Chinese officials in power now don't register what Trump is doing as bluster, as many of his critics would maintain, but as an effective, not negotiating stance, but actual policy position.
Well, they do see a lot of posturing from Washington, from Trump administration on the issue of trade. But they also identify that Trump seems to be willing to push the envelope, to push the U.S.-China bilateral trade to the brinks of the precipice to achieve his goals. And that is quite unprecedented between U.S. and China for the Chinese officials. So they have to wonder that, is Trump really bluffing or is there something real there? And based on their experience in the past, since the beginning of 2017 dealing with Trump, I think they have come to the realization that Trump may not fulfill everything or every threat that he has issued, but he will fulfill some. So I think that gives the Chinese a bigger incentive to engage Trump in negotiation and to seek common grounds. And more likely, the Chinese will make concessions.
I wanted to read a comment from our website from Dev. Dev writes, China will steal or take whatever it wants, and many Americans are ready to accommodate for a price. That is called capitalism with no moral. While we are talking, many technologies are being transferred to China. A slightly different critique is available to us from Montreal, Canada. Michael, bienvenue. You're on the air.
Yes, bienvenue. Thank you for taking my call. I just want to put things quickly in a historical perspective. I think 100 years ago, the United States needed first to develop its own domestic economy. So it, you know, kept out certain powers at the time, European trading nations, out of the game until it developed its own economy and became a great world, you know, trading power after the Second World War. So China is kind of doing the same thing that any rising, you know, commercial and trade power does. So I just wanted to put a historical spin on that.
Yun Sun, what do you make of that?
Well, of course, every country will resort to any way that is possible to focus or to facilitate its domestic economic growth. But then the difference I would point out now is that there is a rule. There are international regulations and there are international rules coming to what kind of trade practice are regarded as legal and regarded as acceptable. And the bottom line is the Chinese government will be in a position to determine what their trade policy looks like. That is their sovereignty. That is their decision-making. That's their rights. But they will also have to be prepared to handle and deal with consequences of their trade policies. And when that consequences means additional tariffs or sanctions from the United States, the Chinese will have to evaluate whether it is worth their while. They will have to do their cost-benefit analysis.
Very sort of on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being most likely, how likely do you think it is that we actually have some real tariffs being changing hands and that there's a real escalation of trade war as opposed to ongoing talks?
Well, there have been a lot of posturing from both Beijing and Washington. Like Washington, first of all, announced all the sanctions and the tariffs, the special 301 investigation on China. And then the Chinese countered us. The Chinese also put their punitive list or their sanction measures to counter the U.S. moves. But so far, none of that has really been implemented. Mm-hmm. So what we're looking at is that the both sides are trying to pave the ground to achieve their best position for the upcoming trade negotiation between the two. And I expect the result of the trade negotiation is not going to be satisfactory for either side. But it's not going. But it's also going to help us to avoid a trade war, because both capitals and both countries understand a trade war is in nobody's interest. It's not good for U.S. and it's not good for China. So I would say that we are seeing a lot of posturing so far.
Dan Griswold, I want to ask about the degree to which we see, you know, China is such a big player on the world scene. It is a major economic player. We see them expanding in places like Africa, South America. You know, I thought about that for the first time when I moved into my neighborhood in New York, and there was a Chinese-Cuban restaurant, which was, I think, a vestige of the Cold War days and emigres from there. But, you know, they are there not for Cold War reasons, but economic reasons. And at the same time, there are all these geopolitical things. We need them in a way on North Korea, right? We need them on even, I think, things like the Iran deal. It's important for them to be at least somehow supportive of what we do if we want it. And then they'll be a factor in what we do if we end up pulling out, as the president has warned he may do. To what degree have we to date seen these trade issues and tensions affect the separate geopolitical issues that we deal with China so often?
Yeah, David, they're all intertwined, aren't they? And China is not an enemy the way the Soviet Union was during the Cold War, but of course it's not a friend the way Europe and Japan and Canada and Mexico are to the United States today. So they are a strategic rival. We need to keep our guard up militarily, geostrategically. But let's not forfeit our advantages economically. China is not a first world country. It's not a third world country. It's a middle income country. Their standard of living is still one quarter of what ours is in the United States. And let's remind ourselves that if the last 30 years have taught us anything, it's that free markets are better than central planning. Central planning doesn't work. China can have all the plans it wants. It doesn't make it so. And they've got some very serious issues hanging over them. One is demography, right? Demographics. They have a plunging birth rate. Their workforce is actually starting to shrink. They have a rapidly aging population. In a decade from now, they're going to have more Chinese over the age of 60 than our entire population in the United States. That's going to be very expensive. They have inefficient state-owned enterprises. Keith mentioned the bad debt hanging over its financial system. We have a more open, flexible, free, dynamic economy. Let's not give that up in some sort of showdown tit for tat with China. That would, as Yoon said, that would be not good for anybody.
It sounds like you're saying, you know, we may perceive them from the outside as being this growing behemoth, this daunting rival, if not enemy, but that they've got their own complications, even as we sort of are hyper aware of ours.
Yes, and let's encourage them to incrementally be more like us, a more open economy, more respect for the rule of law and intellectual property. And they are moving in that direction. China's not the same as it was 20 or 30 years ago. They've lowered their trade barriers. They are collecting more. They are paying more intellectual property payments today than they were in the past, $30 billion to foreign holders of intellectual property. That ranks them number four. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce rates countries according to intellectual property protection. And China's in the middle of the pack. Of the 50 nations the U.S. Chamber rated, China was right in the middle, a little behind Mexico, a little ahead of Turkey, way ahead of Brazil. And Russia and countries like that. So they're not us. We can't demand that they be like us. But let's encourage China to move in the right direction. And these blustery trade threats are not going to yield a positive fruit when you're dealing with a sovereign country like China.
Dan Griswold, take a moment, just like 1 minute, and explain what it would be. I mean, let's set this up. Let's take we have a comments done by Steve Mnuchin. He's the secretary, Treasury Secretary. He outlined goals for American trade officials for this upcoming trip back on Monday in an interview he had with Fox News. Let's hear what he had to say.
We're looking to have a very frank discussion on trade, on the issues of the trade imbalance. President Trump has been very clear for the last year that he's very focused on the trade deficit, and we're looking to correct that.
Let's say, for example, Dan Griswold, that we did correct the trade deficit, that it was halved or it was cut back by $100 billion or whatever it is he wants to do. Yeah. What would that do to the American economy?
Well, first I have to say that's totally unrealistic.
Totally. No, I get that. I understand. But I'm saying what would it actually achieve?
These. Well, let's say China decided to buy $100 billion more worth of U.S. goods. That would mean fewer dollars coming to buy our treasuries. They'd have to redirect their earnings, and so you'd see changes in the dollar, and we'd probably export less to other countries. You know, David, a good example is our petroleum trade with the rest of the world. We had a $300 billion petroleum deficit 3 or 4 years ago, and thanks to fracking, it's now $100 billion. We've reduced that by $200 billion. Our overall deficit hasn't changed. It's just been rearranged. So they might be able to make some cosmetic changes in our bilateral deficit with China, but it's just going to shift the deficits to other countries. Look, the deficit isn't the result of differing trade policies among nations. It's driven by deeper forces, levels of savings and investment, the comparative advantage that different countries have. So it's the totally wrong metric to judge trade. And if you come in with the wrong metric, you're not going to get good results.
And I want to point out that we did reach out to the Treasury Secretary and to Larry Kudlow, the president's chief economic advisor, and their offices to see if they wanted to offer some comment for today's show, and they declined to do so. Yoon Sun, you study this stuff a lot. How important is China to us as we think ahead to our talks, you know, the talks occurring between the South Koreans and the North Koreans, and the role that we want to play as President Trump prepares for a summit there?
Well, now it appears as a bilateral negotiation or the bilateral meeting between the North Korean leader and the American president will happen somewhere in either in late May or somewhere in June. So it does raise the question as well, since U.S. and North Korea are engaged in direct conversations, what role does China really play? Well, we know that China wants to maintain a central, if not a leading role in the negotiations. But then there's a question as well whether North Korea is willing for China to play that role. And we're not completely confident on that. There has been enough bad blood and bad feelings evolving between China and North Korea in these past few years. So I would say that China can try to be a spoiler. If there is going to be a successful summit between United States and North Korea, and the deal that they're going to reach does not necessarily take into consideration China's national interest. But I would say that most importantly, China cannot stop this from happening, and China would like to play a role. But I think China is also trying very hard to find the venue and find the issues where China's role is indispensable. Because so far, it doesn't appear that China has too much to contribute to this bilateral discussion between United States and North Korea.
You know, I find it fascinating to hear you say that. For so many years, we've heard that China has been sort of this this kind of resentful patron of the North Koreans, to some extent financially kind of absorbing some of the people who escaped for economic reasons, sending them back often, you know, uneasy allies, what should I say? And that it has always been the common wisdom I had thought of many who studied this issue in the past, that if we were ever to make progress as part of direct or multilateral, that is multi-country conversations, that China would have to play a constructive role. Are you now saying that essentially Trump has done the sort of a Beijing bypass where, in effect, the Chinese aren't relevant to it? They're such a big neighbor, right, to North Korea. It seems hard to imagine a world in which they don't have a role here. But it sounds like you're saying that this may be a new day.
Well, you're right. First of all, there is a strong sense of China passing in China about not just the United States, but also North Korea, that North Korean leader reached through South Korean envoy to send the invitation to President Trump for the summit. And President Trump just accepted that invitation right then and there on March 8th without consultation with, well, even his own staff, let alone China. So I would say that the sense of China passing has been pretty strong in China since then. But then all these arguments about China playing a critical role in the process of engaging North Korea has one precondition, and that is North Korea provocation. So North Korea keeps its provocation to poke the international community, and there's no other way to bring North Korea back to the negotiation table. That's where we see China has been that key venue to engage North Korea and bring North Korea to the negotiation table.
But go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Now we are faced with a reality, let's see if it is going to be genuine and sincere. North Korea is willing to come to the negotiation table, and they do want to talk.
And therefore, in some ways, China may be a little bit sidelined, an unexpected position. You've been hearing there Yoon Sun. She's co-director of the East Asia Program and director of the China Program at the Stimson Center. She specializes in Chinese foreign policy and U.S.-China relations. Yoon, thanks so much for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you for having me.
Daniel Griswold has also been with us. He's director of the program on the American economy and globalization at George Mason University's Mercatus Center. You can find a link to his op-ed headline, "There's No Pot of Gold at the End of a Trade War with China." That's at our website, onpointradio.org. Dan, thanks so much for joining us today.
David, it's been a pleasure.
Feel free to continue the conversation with us on our website, listen to our podcast, follow us on the Twitters and the Facebook. Coming up tomorrow, Americans sharing their DNA with ancestry websites, good for law enforcement officials, tough for privacy. I'm David Folkenflik. This is On Point.